It's not hard to imagine that a guy who actually built a persona and business out of corporate rating that did nothing else successfully would see the world and diplomacy purely in the terms of corporate rating and power. Uno, dos,
tres. Hey, welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. I'm hosting solo today. And I'm incredibly excited to nerd out a little bit about foreign policy with two amazing guests. So joining us from Los Angeles, making her ITT debut, is Melissa Etihad, foreign affairs reporter for the LA Times. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're happy to have you. And also joining us from Washington, D.C., is In the Thick All-Star, Van Newkirk, staff writer at The Atlantic. Welcome back, Van.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Oh, of course. All right, so I actually want to talk about foreign policy because I think it's being completely ignored, but it feels like it's a checklist item that you have to talk about Barr and Mueller and Trump and the whole saga because it's like 24/7. So I'm going to try to summarize what's happened the last couple of days. So surprise, surprise, President Trump, what's he trying to do? Oh, disrupt congressional investigations. So there you go. And now Bob Mueller, who was going to testify, now he's not going to testify this week. But House Democrats who are like, yeah, whatever, dude, we're probably going to subpoena you. So let's see what's up with that. So maybe you'll testify, Mueller. Who knows? In the mix of all that, there's also this struggle about the taxes. So then on Friday, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee subpoenaed the IRS and the Treasury Department after the Treasury Secretary basically said, nope, we're not going to turn over Trump's taxes. And Trump's like, I'm going to fight every subpoena. And supposedly there's going to be a shitload of subpoenas coming, one from Judiciary, one from the Oversight and Reform Committee, Financial Services, the Intelligence Committee. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump gets a subpoena from the Cafeteria Committee of the House. I mean, there's so many committees that want to subpoena Trump and his and members of an administration. So I guess I just have to ask this question. Where is this going to lead us?
I think that's exactly it. And on your point, I'm kind of getting so confused with everything that's going on. But my thoughts are that we could expect a court fight, you know, that'll test the balance of power between Congress and the White House. And I don't imagine this ending anytime soon. I feel like every week we're going to have to be checking back probably until 2020, you know, even beyond the elections.
Van, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, I think if you've been following the Mueller report and you thought it was going to be over when the report was published, you should buckle up. This is probably going to be a saga that plays out in the courts, plays out over several committee hearings and public testimonies. And it won't be over the next couple of weeks. It'll be over the next few months. It'll probably drag out through the rest of this year. You look at just the timeline for, like we just talked about, the potential court ruling on the tax return issue. That's something we won't expect to be finished for months at least. And so that will be one big piece of it.
Right.
Whether Congress decides to impeach or not, that's still one question on the table. And it's one dependent on the ongoing conduct of the Trump administration. So there's so many variables in the air right now. If there is an over and under on how long it's going to take to be resolved, I would take whatever the over is.
You're taking the over. Yeah, and it's also dominating. I think that's the big thing. It's like it's sucking the air out of the room. And that's why I think it's important to take a pause from all this, because there's so many things happening in the world regarding foreign affairs in the U.S. And I don't know how else to describe it, but it's kind of, quote, like hashtag hot mess, right? So Trump administration right now is dealing with national security crisis with Iran. You have the situation in Venezuela, you have North Korea, and then this trade war with China, which is now becoming news of the week. But I want to focus first on Iran, because we haven't had a chance to really dive deep into this and talk about the issues. Trump, he pulled out of the 2015 Iranian nuclear accord. He did that about a year ago. So then for a year, Iran and all the European countries have still abided by it. But just last week, Tehran said it would stop complying with some parts of the agreements. And then the New York Times reported that there's been recent intelligence suggesting that Iran could be preparing to attack U.S. troops or interests in the Middle East. causing the Pentagon to deploy a Patriot anti-missile battery. I'm like, what is going on? And then in Iran, the situation's getting heated, as CNN correspondent Frederick Plaitkin explained from Tehran.
Well, the Iranians have had a pretty angry reaction, Jim. They're basically blaming the Trump administration for what they say is the escalation of this situation. They say, this is the Iranian government speaking, that the Trump administration is involved in what they call psychological and economic warfare against Iran, and saying that they're trying to ramp up these tensions. At the same time, however, you do have senior Iranian commanders, especially from the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who do some pretty tough talk against the United States. There was one who said that the U.S. would, quote, get hit in the head if it tried to mess with Iran here in this area. And there was another senior IRGC official.
Right. So, Melissa,
yeah,
you've been covering this.
Yeah.
Can you begin to break down this volatile relationship between the United States and Iran historically? And then now you have the Trump administration, you have John Bolton, which I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah.
What is going on? How do we start making sense out of all this?
It's been 40 years since the U.S. and Iran have had tensions. And for a short period during the Obama administration, we saw rapprochement, right? We saw these two sides, these two former adversaries finally coming together. And they had the JCPOA, the nuclear accord. And it was an agreement from the U.S. and other signatories in Europe and Russia and China. And, you know, the basis of that agreement was that in exchange for sanctions relief, Iran would curb its nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to today, and, you know, Iran has upheld its side of the deal, despite the Trump administration reimposing tough sanctions that have had a really awful effect on the people, ordinary Iranians. And that's one thing that I think we don't hear enough of, just really who's being impacted by that. Then finally, this week, Iran decided to flex its muscles, and that's what we saw. But I think what's interesting is that a lot of this has been hyped up. What Iran really announced this week that, you know, it's nothing that has necessarily gone into effect yet. There's 2 months before we'll see whether Iran is going to really, you know, stockpile and enrich its uranium,
right,
and start reproduction of that kind of stuff. So at the moment, you know, it's just a waiting game to see how the European signatories of the nuclear accord are going to respond.
Right. Van, jump in.
Yeah, right now, I mean, I think we're in sort of the waltz of the diplomatic dance right now. You know, people are portraying Iran going sort of back on some of the voluntary pieces of the agreement as, you know, they are going back to building the bomb. You know, I think what's really happening here is they are placing pressure on their UN partners to defy the United States. And so we're focusing on two different dimensions of the diplomatic realm here. One is our eroding diplomatic, I don't want to say eroding, it's eroded, it's gone, diplomatic relationship with Iran. We've already got carriers in the Persian Gulf. You know, we are definitely becoming more and more aggressive under John Bolton. But also, you're looking at what's happening with the transatlantic relationship with the UK, with Germany, with France, and also with them as the middle partner between our relationship with Russia. So there's these three different dimensions really happening right now, and I think there's tension at each one. We'll see how the UN partners, Iran's UN partners on the existing deal, how they decide to react. They're trying to find a middle path. They want to keep the deal going, but they also are trying to ramp down aggression from the United States and from Iran.
Yeah.
I think we'll see exactly how the lines get drawn out again, but, you know, I don't know how it's going to happen.
Yeah. And then when I heard that the United States was deploying a Patriot anti-missile battery, I instantly like thought about the first Gulf War when we were, you know, with the invasion of Kuwait and we were fighting against Iraq. Is the Trump administration adopting a war hawk policy here, or is it just, help me make sense of this?
It's definitely draconian. I think a lot of the analysts I've spoke to, though, are really hesitant to say that, you know, we're on the path to war. I think that's a little bit premature. But just as Van was saying, you know, this announcement by Iran is really putting pressure on, you know, Britain, France, Germany to see if, you know, they're going to do more to save the deal or if they're going to watch it collapse. But for Europe, you know, they're tied into a small box. If they were to give more economic relief to Iran, that would put their businesses at risk because they don't want to be violating U.S. sanctions. And so I think within the next 2 months, we're going to see what happens. I think Iran is kind of giving themselves a little bit of wriggle room. They don't want the deal to collapse. And that's good news.
Right, right.
So that's the silver lining, I think, in all of this.
But Van, I don't know if you read this Washington Post piece over the weekend about Trump's foreign policies. But one of the things that the Post piece talks about is how Trump has this go big or go home approach to foreign affairs, where this talk about applying maximum pressure to multiple nations simultaneously. Like, this is sort of the play right now that shows, like, I'm tough. How much do you think that is caused by politics, or is that by beliefs of the people in his administration? Or is he really trying to just frame this for, I'm a tough, make America great again. We've been tough in the last 2 years and I'm running for re-election.
I mean, I think a big part of it is framing, is Trump and his administration wanting people to see him as a tough deal maker.
Yeah.
As the guy who was on TV on The Apprentice. But also, it's not hard to imagine that a guy who actually built a persona and business out of corporate rating that did nothing else successfully just about, would see the world and diplomacy purely in the terms of corporate rating and power.
Mm.
And I think this conversation we're having with Iran is a pure reflection of that. You know, his administration, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, they are applying this maximum type of pressure. It seems like Bolton will settle for nothing less than regime change almost within Iran.
Yeah.
And they keep moving the goalposts. And for them, collapse is a perfectly fine option in the end. And that is, for better or for worse, that's a perfect reflection of existing corporate rating policy. So, yeah, I think it is both selling an image, but also, you know, there are the principles underneath that are Wall Street.
And Melissa, just on that note, you're saying that Tehran is being cautious and we don't know what they're going to do. But I would assume that when you have this Trump policy of, you know, maximum pressure and there's talk about getting tough, that it's bringing up some old ghosts in Iran, right? I mean, what are people saying about Trump's policy in the country?
No, absolutely. Just kind of going off what Van was saying, they're worried that the Trump administration is going towards this regime change. And when you look at who Trump surrounds himself with, you know, for example, Giuliani, he's been supportive of regime change in Iran. He supports this very cultish group. It's called the MEK, and they've had a history of advocating for regime change. No one in Iran even supports them. But then, you know, you have Trump administration people who are going to these events, you know, bought by the MEK, getting money from them. So it's just very, very disturbing. And it's just mind-blowing kind of where we're going to go from here.
Yeah.
I think Iran's holding out to see what will happen in the 2020 elections. And they're betting on whether Trump will be there or not to make their next moves.
Hey, welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And today I'm joined by Melissa Etahad and all-star Van Newkirk. Let's get back to the conversation. This is happening. All of a sudden, here we go. We have an escalating trade war. Let's just now have an escalating trade war with China. Let's just do that as well. So, as people know, Trump has hiked U.S. tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods. He straight up lied. There's no other way to say it, at a press conference last week, and said that ultimately it's paid for by China. But then I'm sure you guys have seen White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow. He went on Fox News on Sunday and said that what Trump said is basically not true.
If it's a tariff on goods coming into the country, the Chinese aren't paying.
No, but the Chinese will suffer GDP losses and so forth with respect to a diminishing export market and goods that they may need for their own.
I understand that, but
economy.
The president says China doesn't. China, it pays the tariffs. They may suffer consequences, but it's U.S. businesses and U.S. consumers who pay, correct?
Yes, to some extent. I don't disagree with that. Again, both sides will suffer on this.
So the U.S. announces that. Then China says, all right, we're going to raise tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. goods by June 1st. So I guess it gives the countries some time to make a deal. But this trade war is going to hurt Americans, especially some of the people that Trump promised to protect. It's going to raise the prices of pretty much everything. And who knows? It could damage the U.S. economy. But again, here it seems like here's another line in the sand. Trump is getting tougher on China. You know, he's going to be the toughest guy on China during the 2020 election, because we saw his campaign words in 2016. They would play out in things like this. So, Melissa, let me ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Weaponizing China in the election season, is this another chaos strategy by Trump? Is there any value from getting into a trade war with China?
Well, I think what we can take away from all of this is that relations have changed. You know, despite having our business relations deeply intertwined, China and the U.S. view themselves as, you know, aggressive rivals who are trying to get a foot over each other when it comes to global influence and geopolitical power. None of what we've seen over the last 2 years has been very positive in terms of how our relationship with China is going. And it's gone from tense to worse, in my mind, based on what's happened.
Van, jump in. What do you think? I mean, how do you get your head around this one?
Well, I do believe that it's probably a mistake to view the ongoing trade negotiations purely as an economic issue. For both countries, it's an extremely political issue.
Mm.
And like Melissa said, you know, we're talking about two countries jockeying for wanting to be the superpower, and they view getting any concession from the other side as a political victory back home. Trump wants China to be seen as coming back to him begging.
Right.
And the calculus is that if China does concede on a deal, he will win more from that than he's losing from, say, farmers. And, you know, like, the big farmers are hurting, yes, but the people who are hurting most from this in the United States right now are the smaller farmers who aren't getting as much of the big subsidies he's paying people to essentially offset the political cost. We'll see as we get close to the election, I think, how the deal making goes. But, of course, a big feather in his cap would be if China comes back on, you know, I don't even know if it has to be a truly advantageous trade policy for the U.S., but they just have to be able to spin it that way.
It has to be something. Melissa, do you think China would sort of back down a little bit here with Trump?
Yeah.
And kind of lead to a political victory for him?
Right. I think that if the negotiations don't reach a deal in the coming weeks, we'll see that both economies will be hurt. And I think both sides will eventually want to find a way to end it. The question is really, what's next? And I think that Trump, again, has been doing something that's just kind of like unlike any other president that we've seen. So we're just going to have to hang tight and see what happens next, in my mind.
Yeah. So one of the things about this China trade story, I was kind of like, yeah, this is what the rich white people are talking about. There's a lot of wealth being involved. But there's something else that's going on in China that should be getting more attention, I think. The detention of 1 million ethnic Uyghurs and other minority Muslims who are being put in internment camps in China's northwest region of Xinjiang. And basically, President Trump hasn't said anything about this because he's got to focus on his trade war. The Defense Department has condemned China's detention of Muslims. And in Congress, there's actually a bipartisan support for imposing sanctions or taking other measures to end the internment. But here we go. I mean, the Trump administration has refused to take any action. And China's government initially said, like, this was all, you know, vocational training. They called them vocational training camps. And some were called re-education camps for so-called extremists. But any journalist that's trying to get into these camps, they've been taking on these government-sponsored media tours. They're not getting the full picture. But there have been reports of torture and even death in these camps. And you can say that the lack of media coverage has a lot to do with China's secretive government. But, I mean, honestly, Van, if you told me there was 1 million Christians being locked up in detention internment camps in some parts of the country, I mean, wouldn't this be a bigger human rights story in the United States?
Well, from the administration standpoint, I think their primary consideration is strategy right now. We were just talking about the trade deal. We know if they come out with a hard line against China, if they say, you know, if they just advocate for the components of the bill that's circulating through Congress and try to, I don't know, impose sanctions on Chinese officials who are engaging in these camps, they know it's going to complicate the business of the trade deal.
Right.
And also, I mean, I think it's clearly for the Trump administration, for a group of folks who are kind of the poster boys right now globally for Islamophobia, for the administration's own policies along the border with the detention centers it's building. It's going to be a hard line if it really wants to take a line here to walk without losing lots of, I guess, if you want to take the bloodless term here, bargaining power with China. But also it's just, you know, I don't know if the administration is moved by hypocrisy, but I do think it's not necessarily a moral issue for them whether another country is enacting broadly Islamophobic policy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Melissa, what are your thoughts?
Let's just take a step back for a minute and think, like, when has U.S. foreign policy ever been based on, you know, a moral grounds of helping other people?
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. And so the administration might be trying to say that, you know, their U.S. foreign policy goals are trying to help other people. But I just think historically, we haven't really seen that ever in play. And this is just another example of that. And let's look at the response from, like, the broader Muslim world when it comes to what's happening in these camps. They've been muted on it. And it's Ramadan. You know, it's a time for people to, you know, look back and reflect. And I really haven't seen any other Muslim countries except, you know, Malaysia and Indonesia criticizing what China's doing. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. And Saudi Arabia is defending China, basically saying that China can establish these camps in the names of national security, which is like, but Turkey, on the other hand, has actually issued a very strong statement condemning what China has done.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge story. And I think it's a global, I think it's a world headline story. But when I turn on my outlets, I get my hockey coverage more than I get this, at least in the Boston area right now. You know what I'm saying? It feels like what we're witnessing is something just that is highly problematic. You know, I do want to shout out Sigal Samuel of Vox, and she's been covering this for a while. But in the end, the reason, from what I understand, that they don't want this group to separate themselves and they're labeling them as being extremists, as Muslim extremists, because that's the area where all the energy is in China. They need that. They need the resources. So there seems to be a lot of hypocrisy in a lot of ways. I'm with you, Van. I don't expect the Trump administration to come out and condemn anything. I mean, is there a part of the Trump administration that says, yeah, we should be detaining Muslims? Yeah, we should get tough on the Middle East. So that, I think this is all connected.
Well, echoing your endorsement of Sigal's reporting, you know, she's doing a great job. And I'm following her work and think it's gold standard. But I think what that work highlights is that we don't have necessarily kind of information and transparency on what's happening to the Uyghurs in China to really, I think, as a public, quite understand exactly what's happening and where to go from there. So one practical thing that international leaders can ask for is perhaps independent observers of the camps having some more confirmation information about them at all would help inform not only the international diplomatic response, but us as readers, as citizens, as global citizens,
yeah,
our understanding.
So I don't know if a lot of people know this, but to put a final point on this story, Eric Prince, you know, founder of Blackwater, he has business interests in this region. And, you know, Eric Prince also has connections with the Trump administration because Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is his sister. So this is a story that I think we will be following more and more. We're going to move to our final segment. It's called 2020 Shit Show.
Oh, that's fun.
So we're basically calling it as it is, Marie and I. So let's talk a minute about, white male privilege with many of the 20-plus Democratic candidates. So on Saturday, 2020 candidate Pete Buttigieg, he spoke at the Human Rights Campaign Gala in Las Vegas, and he said this.
I may be a part of the LGBTQ community, but being a gay man doesn't even tell me what it's like to be a trans woman of color in that same community. Let alone an undocumented mother of four, or a disabled veteran, or a displaced auto worker. But being gay, just like every other fact about me, from where I grew up to what I look like, means that I have a story. And if I look to that story, I can find the building blocks, not only for empathy, but for the impetus to action.
So then he also criticized, quote unquote, identity politics. What he said was identity politics could actually split people apart at a time when they need to be united. So, Melissa, I'll start with you. What do you think about what Buttigieg has done, and how should these white male candidates face their privilege in this race?
Yeah, that's a really big question. And I think just off that clip, what we listened to is he's acknowledging his privilege, and he's also reaffirming the identities of people who have been marginalized and who necessarily haven't really been heard in any election. And I hope that that rhythm really continues. I think that's what people want. People are hungry. People want to be heard and felt, and especially women of color. And so it was kind of refreshing to hear that. I mean, what did you think about it?
I do feel when you hear someone say like identity politics, and it does come from someone who's a white male, not to generalize everyone. I mean, seriously, but it does feel to me that sometimes when it comes from white men are owning their privilege and say, well, identity politics is going to divide us. I feel like identity politics has, you know, you're a white man. Mm-hmm. That's been identity politics too, but we don't talk about that. You know what I'm saying? I feel like he's only offering like half the answer.
No, that's true.
You know what I'm saying? When you try to push back against white privilege, you get a little bit of like pushback.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's where I'm struggling with this whole notion of the great white man savior named Mayor Pete, which I'm kind of like, so I'm kind of mixed with this. I'm kind of mixed, Melissa. So,
yeah, you don't want that white savior. I mean, that we've seen that so often. And I think people are finally like opening up to this idea that like, yeah, like we have this white savior complex of like the white man going and saving that poor, you know, person who doesn't have agency in the world, where you're right, it should be the other way around. It's about empowering people and giving them the platform.
My point being, he's saying, I'm going to own my privilege. And there's a part of me that's like, maybe don't run and maybe have someone up, maybe have more POC run. So that's my problem. It's like people are owning their white privilege and then being like, but I'm still here and I still want to win this. So,
yeah,
I don't know. But what do you think, Van?
So the first thing for me is I want anyone who uses the term identity politics to define what it means. And that's a sticking point for me, because I have no idea when people use it, and they use it always as a pejorative. I have no idea what they intend by the phrase. It's the same way, I guess, as political correctness, right? Politicians probably going to get high marks for coming out and railing against political correctness regardless. Same thing with identity politics. I have no idea operationally what they mean. And honestly, you all were talking about how a person like Pete Buttigieg can, I guess, leverage his privilege or, you know, actually highlight the voices of the trans woman or the immigrant woman with four children that he's talking about. One way he can do that is with policy. Mm. And so he is the guy who's famously been kind of anti-policy throughout his run. And if he wants to provide a voice to the people across the spectrum and get away from being the white guy in the front of the pack, you know, and actually run a campaign built on solidarity, it would behoove him to actually build some policies based on solidarity. Actually go out and talk to some people in these neighborhoods, in these communities, build and recommend different policies that help them. That's generally how politicians run races. Yeah, and I think he should do that.
I agree with you, Van. For me, identity politics means anything that's not white and male, right? It's become sort of this go-to label of, you know, immigrant activists or Latinos, or like everyone has an issue. Everyone's identifying. And I'm not trying to downplay Buttigieg there, but the irony of him saying I'm not into identity politics. And then he goes on Univision with my friend Enrique Acevedo and eats tacos and talks in Spanish. And for someone who's like rejecting identity politics, it's like you are actually going for it. You're actually like, well, here I am going to pander to Latino voters who are Spanish speaking. So you can't have it both ways, Mayor Pete. That's just what I'm saying, Melissa. I mean, I probably ranted a little bit too much, but do you have any final thoughts?
No. I agree with you. If you could see me right now, I'd be nodding my head and like snapping my fingers with like agreement with both of you guys. I define identity politics as you know, someone who has a really strong character and they're trying to use that as a way to get people, you know, immersed in them and like whatever they're saying and to avoid any of the other policy issues that might actually be at play.
Yeah, I mean, I hate being the policy guy because it's kind of boring, but
it's not boring.
What I want to hear is how his administration in the city he's currently the mayor of has enacted policy or to help protect trans women of color from violence. You know, I want to hear what he's talking about in terms of protecting the more vulnerable people within LGBT. The group of folks who are facing violence the most are people of color there. And so how do you protect them from violence? How will you?
Yeah.
And this is a thing I keep hammering over and over again. There are basic protections that a politician can promise, even within the sort of pandering role. We know politics is a pageant. I'm not going to take away if people enjoy the pageant, but you've got to attach some hard pieces of promises. And I would hate to see a person make it through this whole process without putting forward real promises people can hold them to.
Melissa Etihad, foreign affairs reporter for the LA Times and All-Star Van Newkirk, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining me on In the Thick today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Julio Rigalo-Varela. And wait, guys, before you go, big reminder, Thursday, May 30th at DePaul University in Chicago. It's the third annual Live in the Thick recording with Edna Chavez, Isabella Gomez of One Day at a Time, local activists. Guess what, guys? It's free. So all you got to do is just go to our socials. We have an Eventbrite page, and you just have to click on RSVP, enter your name, and you can come and see some Live in the Thick recordings. So we hope to see you there in Chicago. And remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us because it really, really helps, guys. Also, you can listen to In the Thick now on Pandora, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell all your friends. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Noor Salvi. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. Hey guys, we will see you next time. Thanks again for listening to the show. Nos vemos. Ciao. Bye.
Opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.